real butch little girl. And
what a trip.
She drew, you know.
Well, what's up? What's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. I'm your host, Kiff VH, and I am finally, at long last, joined by my friend and fellow voice NATO performer and fellow voice actor and impressionist, voice matcher, Andre Soliuzzo. Andre, thank you. Did I get it right?
You did. Very well done.
After failing for 5 years.
That's okay.
During our...
But once you the great thing about my name is once you remember it, you never forget.
I'll never forget.
It's locked in.
It may be my last word on the planet.
That's it.
I don't know that I've ever, like, really done a deep dive with you, really. I mean,
no.
We just kind of...
I don't think so.
Most of the conversations we had were usually about 30 minutes before we go on stage.
That's right.
At Stan Lee's Comic-Con. Well, where are you from originally? You're from New York,
aren't
you?
I'm from all over the place. I'm originally from New York. Born in Manhattan. My dad is retired now, but he was a theater professor.
Really?
And he was always kind of chasing tenure a bit. And
where was he a professor at?
Well, that's why he was chasing. So when I was born, he was in the sort of city University of New York system. Like, I think he was teaching at Brooklyn College and that. And at that point, finishing his doctorate. But then he got a job up in the SUNY system, State University of New York.
Okay.
Kind of like the UC system in California.
Gotcha.
And so we were in Brockport for a couple of years, which is right near Buffalo, and then Albany for like 4 years. It's at the SUNY Albany system.
Gotcha.
And actually, one of his students when I was a little kid is the now deceased Joe Alasky.
Really?
Was one of my dad's students when I was a little kid. I must have been like 4 or 5. And I would go and watch, you know, when I wasn't in school, I would just go and hang out with my dad. He'd be directing plays and teaching. And Joe was like this big 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old, and he was in a show that my dad was doing.
Oh, wow.
A Commedia dell'arte thing. And so that was what was funny. And I had sort of, I remembered him-ish.
Yeah.
And then years and years ago, we were at an audition one day, and Joe and I, one of those rare auditions where you're both auditioning at the same time, and we both slated, and I said my name. Which, as you know, Soliuzzo stands out. And
he
chased me out in the parking lot. He said, "Excuse me, are you related to Richard Soliuzzo?" I said, "Yeah, he was my dad." He goes, "He was my professor at SUNY Albany, and I did a play with him." And then I said, "I remember you. I was a child, but yeah." So that was just really random. But yeah, so he was at SUNY Albany, and then he got a Fulbright scholarship. And he was writing a book on an Italian playwright called Luigi Pirandello. Then brought us to Italy while he did his research for that book.
Wow.
And I lived there for about a year or so in Rome as a little kid in the mid-70s. And
How old were you at that time? Like,
from there, he had a teaching position waiting for him at UT Dallas.
Okay.
Which was just opening up. University of Texas, Dallas. But I would spend summers in Michigan because my mother's family was from there.
Okay.
So Texas, so they're spread around. And then eventually he quit academia. We were in Texas for like 5 years. So I'm kind of like a military brat, even though I was a teacher's kid.
Right.
And then he started speech writing for Rockwell International, which built the space shuttle.
No kidding.
And they were based out here. So they transferred him to L.A. and they were in Downey, but he didn't want to live down in Downey. And then so we lived in kind of northern, not even, I call it Orange County, even though it was technically L.A., that sort of pocket of Whittier, La Habra, Bullets and all in there.
Yeah.
So I was there from high school. I did a little bit of college, and then I moved back to New York on my own.
Really?
When I was about 19. But, yeah, so.
Were you doing, when you moved back to New York, did you go to, transfer to college there, or were you kind of just saying, screw it, I'm going to go out?
Exactly. And... my initial plan was I was in school, and I was going to, like, I was going to college, going to transfer to UCLA, and then I said, you know what? I finally admitted that I was an actor. I didn't want to be an L.A. actor kid.
You fought that impulse to work in this market?
Yeah,
or just...
The other thing was, since I was raised in academic theater, I had a better academic theater education than anybody at that age walking into a university. So it was ridiculous. I was like, why would I get into all this debt to go, you know, sort of wear a powdered wig and do bad checkoff, you know, like, so, right. You know, when I can go do bad checkoff in workshops in New York.
That's right.
So, I had so much experience. I did children's theater as a little kid, but I was never a professional actor kid. And when I would meet professional actor kids, no knock on them now, but I always hated the vibe. I didn't like the chops.
I understand.
Again, the device of TV back then was much more artificial than it is now.
Yes.
So kids were given a lot of bad habits. And they were very present for adults. And they had that little commercial sheen on them. And they kind of looked like Stepford children. And they creeped me out.
Yeah.
So I didn't, you know, I just didn't relate to that whole world. And it also, L.A. being a town where everybody was an actor or trying to make it. You know, I just was like, you know, and also I was ready to go back to New York because I moved around so much. I had a weird identity crisis in that I was always the new kid and I was never really from where I was living.
Yeah.
And so New York became a tremendously strong identity every time we would go back. And I knew just about the age of 14, I went back for a summer or part of a summer. And I said, that's it. When I'm an adult, I'm moving back here as soon as I can. This is home. Because like everything else was, New York was home and everything else was in the meantime.
Yes.
So, right at about 19, I remember I came out for part of a summer, and then that following February, that was it. I was in, and I moved back on my own and started my life in New York and sort of, you know, initially just... That was the other thing, was like, now I realize, as a career goes, it was probably the wrong approach, but emotionally and intellectual, I thought, what business do I have walking into an audition? I know a tremendous amount, but I've not actually done it enough.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
I didn't, you know, as to where actor kids develop all these chops by being kind of crummy as little kids and getting away with it.
Right.
But then they grow. So by the time they're an adult, they've got a tremendous amount of experience. So for me, I knew I was really talented, but what I lacked was the sort of fearlessness of like, hi, it's me and you should hire me. I thought, I don't have the right to ask for a job right now. What do I know? Little did I know. No, yes, you do. At 18, walk in the door because you're cute and they'll just stick you in front of a camera if you have any talent.
Right.
And
when you have the level of background that you've got and the knowledge and the technique and the constant honing at the dinner table. Like the 10,000 hours idea being applied off the clock, you know, because you grew up in that environment.
Yeah. So... That became like, so I was studying and working and then started doing black box theater.
Mm-hmm.
But then also I was already musical, but I started writing songs. I started playing in the park and then I got into the sort of last gasp of the Real Village folk scene.
What did you play?
I still play. I songwrite, I play guitar and sing and songwrite. So at that point, I started playing in like the coffee houses on McDougal Street and Third and all over the Village. And there was still, you know, Dave Van Ronk was still hanging around and with everybody. And like, there was still the old folkies from the 60s were still around and still there.
Man.
And Suzanne Vega had just broken.
Oh,
around
yeah.
Around that time, out of that scene the year before.
Bum, bum, bum,
We were all, you know, we were all just, so it was still a really wonderful, thriving live. So in the summers, we'd hang out in Washington Square Park and play. And then, then you'd go to the clubs and play. And then I would be doing theater down at HB Studios. And then, you know, it was just a really wonderful time. It was kind of the last also really good grungy New York, 86 kind of onward. It was like, you know, they started to clean it up in the early 90s and turn it into Disneyland.
Yeah.
But I was there when you could still starve affordably, you know, and get into trouble, but it was still really kind of wonderfully grimy and alive.
Well, like, what a scene to find your kind of adult identity.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it was a wonderful, wonderful time to be in New York and to just meet other actors and musicians and people I knew. I used to hang out. Paget Brewster and I used to be very close.
Oh, really?
I met her one day. I was playing in Washington Square Park, and here came this little mini sprite goddess, Paget. And she was the first girl I ever met who could do accents as I could. And we hit it off and became very close friends.
And I mean, not to interrupt that story, but going back to accents and dialect, is mm-hmm. that like, because we're in that same kind of space of voice matching yeah. and that kind of stuff. Where did that start for you?
That started as an early, I call it a disease that all, those of us who do what we do kind of have, you just can't control it. So yeah. it started as a little kid and probably... Well, accents and impressions. Again, as you hear my story, I moved around a lot. Also, my dad worked, was involved with the Edinburgh Festival when I was little.
Really?
So I had like my sixth birthday in Edinburgh in August, you know. And so that was the first time. And, you know, you remember we had TV, but we had Masterpiece Theater. You'd hear British people. And like, sure, I was born in Manhattan. But then once you leave and go out to the burbs, back then, you weren't exposed to people from all over the world.
Yeah.
So suddenly to go to England and like, these people speak my language, but they sound really different.
Yeah.
And so I just couldn't help but imitate them, you know. So I started honing the otherness of other people from the age of like 5, 6, 7. And I just started, especially Scottish. Like British was easy to understand, but, you know, you walked into a Glasgow or like was like, I didn't know what they were saying.
Oh, man.
You know? Yeah, it was intense. So I just started to naturally mimic. And like the rest of us, I was, you know, always the kid sent out to the hall for being disruptive. You know, I spent a lot of time in the hall as a kid. And yeah, so you turn what you couldn't help doing eventually into an income. But yeah, so accents, I just became very, very, you know, my first probably on the record impression, because we used to have a little tape recorder when I've long since lost the tape, is I was about 6 or 7 and I was in love with Elizabeth Taylor from National Velvet.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she was adorable and beautiful and she's riding her horse and oh my God, she's so cute. And, you know, I'm 6 and I've got this boy crush on 10-year-old Elizabeth Taylor, the older woman.
Right.
Well, then we go see the movie That's Entertainment.
Yes.
Right, which was all the clips of the great MGM musicals. And out walked probably at that point a 40-something Liz Taylor.
Yeah.
And I couldn't reconcile this older woman. You know, what happened to the little girl that I'm in love with? You know, who is she? And she was talking about Peter Lawford, this handsome young man on the screen. And so as a little kid, I could, of course, match a woman's voice really easily.
Yeah.
So I walked out imitating Elizabeth Taylor, you know, in the movie That's Entertainment. And then my dad just, like, turned on the tape recorder. So, yeah, I used to do Liz Taylor and then John Wayne as a little kid, which I don't even do now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah, so I was that was like we used to have like a recording of me with this little kid voice doing Elizabeth Taylor. And if I remember, it was pretty good, you know. But yeah, that's kind of how it was one of those things. You couldn't help yourself, and
you know,
you just kept doing
it. I understand that compulsion completely. It's like finding, as a kid, you do all those little tricks of like what. You know, can I shake a pencil and make it look like it's bending? How many quarters can I catch off my shoulder?
Yeah.
You know, all these are not shoulder. That's impossible. Elbow is what I'm showing. But then as you start to play with your voice and discover, hey, here's my little trick and I can do, you know, like for me, it was all cartoon characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I thought if I could get Rich Little, then I could get everybody he could do.
Right.
Which was not true at all, but I was working on a Nixon and a Johnny Carson and all that. Well, cut back to Washington Square and you meeting Paget.
Okay, so I meet Paget. So, yeah, we became friends, and but that was our immediate bond is like, because Paget speaks fluent French. And at that time, you know, we met and suddenly we were just hanging out. She says, who are you? And she says, oh, I'm going. It was just one of those things where you meet someone and you just lock.
Yeah.
And so we were just walking around. We went to a party and then the night went to the morning. We're walking around and doing accents. And it was like just suddenly she broke into some accent because she had the same disease we do.
Yeah.
And Paget went into it. And then I went. And so then we used to do these characters, Claude and Monique. And we were this couple who just got here, but we were not really French, but maybe we were. We're from, my name is, hello, I am Claude. I am from Europe, you know. And she would be Monique. And then sometimes I would just, and she had this friend, Claire, who was a model. And then sometimes Paget and I would just suddenly have this fight in the middle of Washington Square, you know.
As these
characters.
And
I would say, you know, where have you been, Monique? You have been with him, have you not? No, I have not. And she would cry, and then she'd start speaking in French. And then suddenly this crowd of people would form because they love conflict. They thought it was a real fight between two Europe, Euro trash in the middle of the park. And then suddenly Claire would walk around and kind of pass the hat. You know, it was like this kind of live guerrilla theater.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so that was like, you know, that was that kind of climate. Like in the summer, you just would go to the park.
Yeah.
And you sort of start to know everybody there. And then you would stay out and you'd go from Washington Square, which is slightly less seedy at that point. And then you'd go to to Tompkins Square, which was really seedy at that point.
Okay.
You know, and then, you know, the Tompkins Square riots was always the dividing line when Giuliani, like, brought in the goon squad to sort of beat up everybody and clean up the city.
Oh, man.
But at that point, you would go, it was really kind of wide open and, you know, drug dealers and homeless people and jugglers. And it was just like, you know. But yeah, so that was like at that time, it was a really fun, really wonderful, fun time.
How did you make the transition from pass the hat
and to working actor?
To working actor.
It took a long time. I started sort of doing, you know, black box theater with people. But I still didn't figure out the whole business of it.
Yeah.
How to get an agent kind of thing. And then I started I started doing production work and commercials, and I knew a lot of ad agency people. And so a lot of my friends were the creatives. They were the ad agency people that wrote the commercials, et cetera, et cetera. And one day I was having lunch with a friend and she said, "Oh, well, I gotta cast this thing tomorrow. I got to meet all these people who do voices. I've got to find somebody who can do Clinton, Elvis, Ross Perot, an alien, and an alien child." And I went, "Well, I can do that." And she's like, "Oh, well, why don't you come in and audition?"
Wow.
So I was like, "Okay." So I came in and I auditioned against 30 other people that day who had agents, and I booked the gig. Back then it was called a CD-ROM, right? Yeah. It was something Newsweek was sending out to their advertisers, and they made this little sort of cartoon thing, and so they needed all these sort of political voices of the time. And so I booked that, and then at that session, randomly enough, an agent was there because one of his clients had booked it, which is unusual. Agents aren't usually at the session.
Right.
So and it was a guy who's still working named John Wasser in New York. I think he's at Atlas now,
okay,
if I remember correctly. And John sort of gave me his card, and I came and met with him. And he's like, "Well, you need a tape." And he goes, "Here's a tape of our best guy who did sort of character voices."
Okay.
And it was an older guy, probably then in his 60s, who was probably one of those heavy hitters that we grew up with as little kids.
Yeah, yeah.
On every Kellogg's commercial or whatever.
Right.
And I heard his tape, and I remember, ego or whatever it was, I hated it. Because I thought it sounded like every cheesy commercial we grew up with.
Yeah.
And as a little kid, I used to listen and go, you know, it's like, "Hello, I am doing a French accent. I am talking to you about this cereal." Yeah. You know, and it was just really cartoony and really in your face. And I would always, as a little kid, I was a purist. You know, I was like, that's not what real French people sound like, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was funny. When I heard his tape, I was like, "Well, I don't want to sound anything like that," ignorant as I was of the business. And so I said, "I'm going to go do something interesting." So I had a friend who was like a sound engineer, and we snuck into the studio one day when his boss was out, and we made this really amazing tape with sound effects and music and voices. And it was like listening to a movie of different characters. And I would just go from one to the next, and it was like 3 or 4 minutes long and way too long,
right?
Way too imaginative, way too outside of the box. And that was sort of the demo I had. And then I gave it back to John, and he was like, "Well, we've all listened to it, but we don't get it." Hmm. "We just don't get it. And, you know, I need something," because they see Babyface come in the door and they wanted me to go, "Hey, 7F's really cool." You know, they wanted that kid.
Right.
And so I was like, okay. And, you know, I just didn't want to be with anybody who didn't just obviously see my talent for what it was, you know. But part of it was, and I can't, looking in hindsight, I don't blame them now, there was no animation market there then, really.
Yeah.
So an agent doesn't have that same eye to go, "Hey, you need to put together this kind of animation tape. You're this kind of character, da 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 da."
Right.
There were some cartoons there, A little bit. Courage the Cowardly Dog was there.
Oh,
then,
sure. So like those like Klasky Csupo style?
A little bit, yeah. Uh-huh. And then, of course, Viacom was, everything was based out of New York. So I'll get to where that went to. But it, okay. So I had this tape. And I had no, you know, and I gave, and every agency producer I gave it to at Deutsch, at BBD Needham, at all these major top agencies, where they'd hear it and go, this is incredible. Yeah. You're amazing. This, you should be working every day. Blah, 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 blah. And it was like, so the irony was the creatives got it.
Hmm.
But the agents who are pitching those creatives
right.
thought that the creatives wouldn't like it. You know, it was that typical thing of like agents hear and see. That's always my advice to young actors when they're starting, is like, if you have a tape, be it on camera or radio or an anime, it has to sound exactly like what the market will bear.
Hmm.
They can't imagine, just because you're super talented doesn't mean they can see you. They want to see you giving them something they can sell tomorrow that looks exactly like something we saw on TV last night or heard on the radio. That's the way that, I didn't know that. Right. I just thought, if you show them how incredibly talented you are, they will see it and they will get you jobs.
Yes.
And that's not it. No. Just always assume nobody has any imagination. You have to give them exactly like what they've heard.
Yeah.
And but I didn't know that lesson then. So I had this tape and I circulated around for like three. Friends would introduce me to agents. Agents would hear it. Oh, sure, I'll hip pocket you. And they wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
And so meanwhile, I kept working. I kept doing readings and little plays. And then I was on a set one day, loading the cooler on a commercial. And a dear friend, my friend Elise Roth, said to one of the executive guys from BBD Needham, because we were on a shoot for a major multi-million dollar commercial or whatever it was.
Were you working crafty on that? Or were you
working? I was just loading the cooler. I'm driving the truck. You know, I was the, and she's like, oh, you got to hear Andre's tape. He's really amazing. And so she gave him my tape and then called me 2 days later. She goes, oh my, and I, to this day, I don't remember his name. Let's just call him Jim Wilson. She's like, Jim Wilson heard your tape and he thought you was incredible. You were incredible. And he's going to pass it off to this agent at William Morris. And I'm like, they're actively looking for talent. I'm like, William Morris actively looking for talent? That doesn't really jive, but okay. Yeah. And I was like, well, what's that guy's name, the agent? And she said, it's Billy something. And I was like, okay. And then I waited. And I thought, okay, you know, another week or two. And
yeah.
And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to be waiting for the rest of my life. So I'm going to lie. I called William Morris and said, and it was Billy Ciro.
Uh-huh.
And I called Billy Ciro's office and I said, hi, my name's Andre Sogliuzzo. You know, Jim Wilson at BBD Needham referred me to Billy. And she's like, hold one moment. And then she's like, Billy, will call you back in 10 minutes. Boom. Because those agency producers are the guys that agents schmooze to get their clients' auditions. That's the way the business works, right. You know? So the minute you have a referral from a top guy at an ad agency, of course. And back then they did everything. It wasn't, you know, he was commercial mostly because there wasn't much animation.
Yeah.
And so Billy called me back and he said, well, why don't I meet you on Friday? You know, that was like a Tuesday. I went in on a Friday. I sat in front of him. He listened to my tape right in front of me.
Hmm.
And he goes, no, this is really good. He said, no, I'll start sending you out. And I said, and then I was so damaged at that point. I said, I said, you know, Billy, I've heard this from several agents that I've met and they never really send me out. I'm just being honest here. Does this speak to you in some way? And he goes, no, this speaks to me. And now the thing about Billy is he came out of casting before he was an agent. So he knew talent. He knew theater. He had a real background in theater and he appreciated talent before he was appreciating the commercial market in a way. So he saw something in me. He saw what I could do and had the imagination that a lot of agents don't allow. Not that the agents don't have imagination. They don't allow themselves to have it because they're busy filling their quota for the day of what the ad agencies are asking for.
Yeah.
So he sort of hip pocketed me and started sending me out. And eventually, I was barely working, here and there. And it was, that agency was very slow in New York at that time.
William Morris?
Even though it was William Morris, it wasn't a top scale agency.
Huh.
So, you know, at that point, if I was having three auditions in a week, it was a really busy week. And New York was different. You ran around town.
You're going to
physical
offices. You were
going either to the ad agency to audition or you were going to casting agents. And it was also a weird time for me because, I mean, I'm fortunate now at my age. I look a lot younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And without the goatee, I really look a lot younger, as you do too.
Yes.
We're both blessed with a nice baby face.
That's right.
So people do typecast you based on how you look, even though it's for a voice spot.
And
they
since
do.
You're going the, into these offices.
And, you know, I have a facility to change my voice. And one of the things that maybe it is not for everybody, but I approach every piece of copy, be it commercial animation, like a character read. Mm. I think, who's the audience for this piece of copy? Who is the market? You know, am I the patrician selling insurance in his 50s? Because even in my early 30s, I could sound like a guy in his mid to late 50s, you know? Or am I like, yeah, 7-Up is really cool. It's awesome. Coors Light, tap the Rockies. You know, like the young 20-something right. dude. But the casting agents they'd resist me reading older stuff or different kinds of copy because they were trying to peg me to read the way I looked.
Yes.
Even though I was like, I get that, but I'm not that guy. I can also give you these 6 other things. And they've heard that a million times. So a lot of actors, every actor thinks he can do everything.
Yeah, right.
So look, Scooter, you're going to do what I tell you and shut up, you know? And so right. that was what I was up against. So I wasn't working as much then. And then what happened is through Billy, I think at that time I was already in SAG from that CD-ROM thing,
oh,
but
so
I
your
wasn't
first
in
gig
after.
Was, okay.
That was my first gig actually got me in the union.
Man.
And then after that, I started doing other stuff too, which is separate.
Sure.
But I'm going voice-wise first.
Yeah.
And then I started booking Celebrity Deathmatch in its original...
On MTV.
MTV. And that was a non-union show then, and I was a non-union actor as far as AFTRA was concerned.
Yes.
And so I started doing that. And, you know, they were just paying one flat fee, and I would do as many characters as they threw me.
Yeah.
But I would audition every week. And they didn't even – they had a casting agent named Kate Rados.
Uh-huh.
And you would just call this hotline at MTV. And leave your auditions over the phone. And I used to annoy the crap out of them because I would do the same thing. I would play music. I would like get into the character, you know, and I'd be doing the voice. And then finally, like a month in, they're like, Andre, would you just please just call and do the voice and stop with the production value? And I was like, okay. But yeah, so I over a couple of years, I did like 50 different voices for them. And at that point, once you start working, an agent will sign you. They won't just hip pocket
you. Gotcha.
And so I was assigned... talent at William Morris at that point, and I was with them in New York for a couple of years. But meanwhile, I was doing other work as an actor and started working. And again, it was a random crisscrossing between being an actor and being a production person.
Yeah.
And one day walking down the street, I ran into another production guy. No, I was walking down the street with this production guy. I think we were on a job.
Uh-huh.
As guy Corey. Corey, whatever his name was. And some woman spotted him. She says, hey, Corey, I was thinking of you for a job. Al Pacino's looking for personal drivers. And so I was like, you know, and he's like, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure. And then I was like, hey, I'll do it. And so she took down my name and number.
Uh-huh.
And then we're walking away, and Corey's like, trust me, dude, you don't want that job. That's a freaking nightmare, you know? And I was like, you know what?
Maybe, but
you know what? So sure enough, I got the call. I went in for the meeting with his assistant. And at that point, I had already met famous people. I had already been on shoots. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of experience. I also could drive anything from a car to a 16-foot truck in Manhattan and park it. You know
Jeez,
what I mean? So
yeah.
I had a lot of driving experience too. So
yeah.
It was like, you know, and they didn't pay well at the time, but I didn't care. And at that point, I was just one day a week.
Mm-hmm.
But so the first day I met Al was literally the first day of shooting on Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I'm just there waiting and in comes like this movie icon looking like $1 million. Says, you know, he's dressed like Ricky Romo. You know, he had a tan, had the hair, the Armani suit, you know, and he was ready to go. He had the junk, the gum, he's chewing that gum, you know. And so I was just like, and you know, I didn't even speak.
Yeah.
He was like, and I went up and I said, hi, my name's Andre. Hi. He's, oh, you're my driver. Oh, okay. Yeah. Is the car here? I said, yeah, the car is here. Oh, okay. So You know, so then I just waited for him, and then we did like a little... At lunch, he took a break, and his office was... We were shooting in Times Square at this Chinese restaurant that's no longer there.
Oh, the scene with Jonathan Pryce.
That's really... It was a restaurant. You know, wow. they dressed it up a bit, but it was a real restaurant.
Wow.
And that was the other funny thing. Is like, I look over, and I see Jonathan Pryce, who I worshipped, and he came out looking like death. And I was like, God, he looks really... Wow, he is just trash, this guy. What an emotional wreck. But you see that scene.
Yeah.
He was living it that day.
Man.
Know? Jonathan Pryce just looked like somebody ran over him with a truck.
Yeah.
You know? And so I remember because he was at craft service and I was like, Jonathan Pryce is going to freaking burst into tears right now, you know? And so, yeah, so it was just this amazing day with that, you know, and we drove. I said nothing. I didn't speak because I was warned, don't, you know, because, you know, Al takes, he's a shy person. That's what people don't realize, you know, he's so big and so out there, but Al's actually tremendously shy and quiet and in his own head for in a way. And so it was like, you know, don't speak until you're spoken to kind of thing. And so I almost said nothing at all. And he just turned while I was driving. He goes, you an actor, Andre? And I said, yeah, I'm an actor. Okay, good. And then, you know, I drop him off and his assistant calls me on the car phone because everyone didn't have a mobile yet.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, Al likes you. He really likes you. He kept asking how old you were, you know, because... Kid looks, what is he, 17? How old is this kid? You know? And so that was sort of it. And then I just slowly started working with Al. And then he started doing this wonderful project called Looking for Richard.
Oh, I love that film.
And Al is like a tornado of creativity. He's a force of nature. And so I, you know, Andre, come over here, sit down. And so we all just started reading, you know. And I would pick up a part here, pick up a part there. And then we were all, so I was involved in the readings. Then I was in the film and... You know, and that went on between different projects. So he took like 3 or 4 years to shoot that.
Did he really?
Yeah, it wasn't all at once. Because if you watch the movie, sometimes he has a goatee. Yep. He looks like Carlito. Other times he doesn't. You know, he has got long hair. So, right. You know, it was over the course of a couple of different, you know, it was on his own dime, on his own time.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a tremendous time in my life as a young actor. Also, if you remember, it was a different world. We didn't have... Mm. The Kardashians shoved down our throat. We didn't have reality TV.
Yeah.
We didn't have a million channels with movie stars being thrown at you. And Al was more than famous even then and now. He wasn't just famous. He was a piece of Mount Mushmore.
Yeah.
You know, he's Tony Montana and you know,
and Michael Corleone.
And that's a different kind of famous.
That's right.
You know, in a way, I mean, I don't, not to belittle, but it was like I used to say, well, he's not just Bruce Willis. He's George Washington, you know what I mean?
That's
and
right.
So when someone would spot Al on the street, it was intense. And now randomly when we would be driving around and just showing up, that was one thing. But when he would do a play on Broadway, I literally, whenever you see those films of like people charging a car and pressed against the glass and throwing themselves on the hood, I was in the middle of that kind of fishbowl many times. And that was terrifying.
Yeah.
And to be in the epicenter of that level of fame was an eye opener as a, you know.
I want to come back to this.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, dude. But what did you pluck that you learn and remember now about being in the center of that?
Of that. Well, the difference between fame, I'll take it from two perspectives.
Okay.
As a young actor, you see your heroes on the screen, and what you see is the finished edit. You don't see the process of getting there.
Yeah.
And what you see are, hopefully, if the actor's fortunate, the best takes and the best cuts, you know, and you see finished product. You never see them being bad.
Yeah.
You never see them trying and failing and then trying something that works, and the same process that every actor goes to when they're finding it.
Absolutely.
And so, and you also never see them being normal people. So that was the first thing. Because again, for the first 6 months that I was with Al, and I worked with him roughly 5 years, you know, we didn't speak a lot. So it was just a lot of me observing.
Yeah.
And experience, one, the life of what it was like to be that famous. But two, this incredible actor who's just so brilliant, slowly being exposed to his process, his private way of working or what he does. And I wasn't always on film sets a lot because Al really doesn't want to be distracted by people he knows.
Yeah.
When he disappears into something, he's in the character and sort of, I think that for him, I won't speak for him, but from what I could tell, the people on that, in that world are the world that he's in that day.
Gotcha.
And so he doesn't want to see, oh, there's Andre. What's he getting a corned beef sandwich in my sight line? Right. You know, that's very, and I get it. Yeah. Now I get it, you know, yeah. And, but I was on some film sets. As I said, I was on Glengarry. I was on Carlito's Way a great deal. I eventually was around, but I also knew to get out of the way and you know. Yeah. But so you start to see. But what I just slowly realized was like, yeah, he puts his pants on one leg at a time just like me. Hmm. Or we're both in the car right now sitting at the light and we're both watching the same. One of the first times I noticed it was I look over and there was a. There's a woman pushing a baby in a stroller, and it was like a little toddler who was just going, getting ready to go for that nap, you know, but they're awake and the head's kind of loose yeah. and suddenly the legs and the arms just splay out and they just like, they look like a drunk. They just go, bleh. And both Al and I, without knowing the other is looking at it, both look over and we both just go, bleh. We both like do this kind of, and I looked over and I was like, he's just like me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and that was a tremendous, suddenly I was not afraid.
Yeah.
I was not afraid of taking that risk. And I watched my hero sometimes be awful, you know, and then be brilliant yeah. and then be awful and then be brilliant. And I was like, oh, because he wasn't afraid of taking a risk. And at that yeah. point, I also became very close friends with Kevin Spacey.
Oh, wow.
And I helped Kevin with many auditions at that time. And we would read together and I would... And so I was around these phenomenal actors.
Yeah.
And I was in it, you know, in that way that was very fortunate. But it wasn't just like, oh, yeah, I'm a working actor with other good actors. I'm a working actor. I mean, Kevin wasn't huge at that point. He was right. fighting his way to the top.
This is like around, well, Looking for Richard, but like the ref Swimming with Sharks kind of in right. that
yeah,
sort
that
of
was,
era.
Yeah. And so right around that period so I would read with Kevin, help him with auditions or whatever. But I just had tremendous respect for what he was, you know. But again, then I became fearless. And then in Looking for Richard, I actually had a scene that was cut out with Al, a two-shot in St. John the Divine in full Shakespearean costume. I'm like a page. Boy! You know. You know.
Knowest thou not any whom corrupting gold will tempt unto close exploit of death?
I know
a man, my lord, whose humble means match not his haughty service. Gold were as good as 20 orators and would no doubt tempt him to anything.
That was my big line. It was this wonderful two-shot and dark, and I was like, I've got a reel! It's incredible! A two-shot with Al Pacino!
Yeah.
And the DP, had, at that time we were still shooting film, had the wrong speed film in the camera, and that day it was too dark. I'm like this frickin' shadow. Yeah, and so it never made the cut. You know, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But after that, I was like, you know what? I was in the big game.
That's right.
I was in the World Series as a schmo. I walked on the play. I didn't get a home run, but I got on base.
That's right.
And that was enough. After that, I was afraid of nothing.
And it's enough for me. I had a very similar, I told you this, in Danny Collins, I had a two-hander with Al.
Right.
And the scene got cut from the film.
Ugh.
And I'm
actually his voice at the opening of that film.
Are you really?
When you see the young...
Yeah, with Nick Offerman?
When they're in the office.
Yeah.
And they had hired the Sicilian actor who looked like Al. I looped his voice.
To do the younger, yeah, you know, the young Al, not the old Al.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, so that's
so
great. We were both in that.
That's right. We're both in that
little
picture.
We both got a $3 residual.
That's right. It's not sold well. It's a great movie.
It
is. Bobby Cannavale's really good in it, too.
I love that movie. Yeah,
me too. I love Fogelman. He was terrific.
Yeah, so that's exactly. You got on base. And after that, I had finally, and that was the other lesson as a young actor. It's like, I knew I had all this confidence and talent, but I had all this fear of failure. And fear of so that's what was holding me back. The other thing was because my life I had spent as a kid watching the process but not actually doing it. Mm. I had a tremendous amount of knowledge. Probably as a young would have started out as a young director. I would have been very good.
Yeah,
because I had the eye of a director because that's what I watched my dad do and I watched actors working from the first read to the final curtain.
Yeah.
Growing up, but so I knew more in a way that made it harder for me to just let go as a performer in a strange sense. I was a great performer with friends and on my own, but once I got on stage, it became much more self-aware and afraid of doing the wrong thing because I knew what the right thing was.
Yeah.
But surrendering to just being you and doing it is a whole other art. And I didn't really learn that until I watched, you know, the tornado that is Al, you know, doing his thing over and over. And so for me, that was like grad school. That was a tremendous. And after that, it just liberated me and encouraged me to just. And Al is a wonderfully encouraging force to be around. He loves actors. He loves process.
Yeah.
He loves doing it and reading it. All right, let's put together a reading. Yeah, we'll do that. And, you know, just actors sitting around reading. And he'll have projects that he just keeps reading and reading for 20, 30 years because he loves them and he something about it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, but that, you know, as impressions go.
Yeah.
That was one of the ones, of course, you can't not be without and slowly develop a good Al, you know.
Of course.
You know, and so I could do Al at that point in a way, you know, just Al in his regular life, being himself, you know. I was with him, you know. And so I knew his tics, and just the way you know your uncle's tics.
Right.
You know, when Al became, even though you're working for him, we became like uncle and nephew, or like, you know, just older mentor, and you know, so that whole thing became, you just absorb, especially someone with my disease absorbs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would do Al all the time when he wasn't around.
Right.
You know, and then one day, you know, at that point, Penelope Ann Miller, who was in Carlito's Way.
Yeah.
And I was in the car with Penny, taking her somewhere at one point, and the phone rang and his assistant called me and she was at a party and she said, Andre, my friend is here. She keeps waiting for Al to call me for something, you know, just whatever. Could you just call and pretend to be him and freak her out, you know? And so I called and I had this innocuous conversation. You're like, hi, yeah. She said, oh, I'll get Price. I said, no. What's your name? Oh, Susan. Yeah, how are you? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Price told me all about you. What are you doing? You know, and I had this. Oh, yeah? What'd you eat? Oh, I can't eat. That makes me gassy. You know, like, I just had this really dumb conversation. And, you know, Penny was just laughing. And it was all, whatever. We just let it be. It was just one of those little moments. About a week later, I'm in the car, and I'm driving both of them to set or something. And and he goes, you know, he's like, oh, you know. Also, the other thing Al would do, because he'd heard my tape at that point.
Yeah.
And he loved my Ross Perot. And, you know, which is now nobody knows who Ross Perot is.
Yeah, right.
Back then, you know.
Right.
You know, I do my Ross Perot. You know, so so whenever he was sort of, you know, a non sequitur to change a subject, he'd go, oh, Andre does great impressions. You know, like he would just sort of use me as like the court gesture.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know, to sort of distract, you know. And, oh, Penny, Andre does great impressions. He's a great Ross Perot. She goes, actually, Al, he does you really well. And I was like, oh. And I just like withered, cold sweat, like, oh, you didn't. Oh, yeah? All right, let's hear it, you know. And then I told him the story that I just told you about the party and the phone call. And then he sat there for a minute and he went, all right, you got me, you know. And then so I just sort of left that alone. And, you know, he kind of sat with it for a while. And then, like, the following week, like any great actor who loves the sound of their own, you know.
Yeah, right.
Like, Andre, Andre, what'd I say? What'd I say? You know, so he would have me do Al for Al, you know. It was
oh, that's so crazy.
It was funny, but that was the other, I can segue into another thing. From that, the one voice, or the one character of all the things Al does, you always think, oh, of course. I mean, it's many years later now, but back then, in many roles and performances, but the one that everybody would come up as, everybody would do Tony Montana.
Yeah.
Every janitor, every garbage man, every postal worker, oh yeah, Tony Montana, oh yeah. If they spotted him, they would shout Tony. Like that was the one.
Yeah.
That every guy on the street related to the most of anything he had done at that point. I would say probably even now. But, you know, the way that character has taken over in the rap subculture and the whole.
Oh man.
Yeah, it's there.
It's pretty incredible.
So I always knew in my heart, I am not going to do Tony Montana for Al. So I never did it.
Yeah.
I just thought, you're not going to do that. I just didn't have the guts or whatever. So that when, you know, this is years later, the Scarface game came around.
Yeah.
And it was time to audition. And, you know, I sent in an audition at that point. It was just for the demo of the game. And that's what I did it twice. So for the demo, they just sent out these lines from the game. And I thought, that's not how you get this part. If you hear Tony Montana, you want to hear, you know, you freaking cockroach, you know.
Right.
I don't know where we're at, if we can swear on our podcast or not.
I like playing it clean. Yeah, I appreciate you making it freaking cockroach, you know, but that's all right.
You know, say goodnight to the bad guy, you know, all that stuff. So
right.
I went home. I walked in the agent's office and I said, you know what? I'm going to come back at the end of the day. And I went home, I got the movie, and I wrote down Tony Montana's greatest hits, and I recorded all of them. And then I played. So I did like 2 minutes of every line, iconic line from the film.
Yeah.
And okay, now I'm going to go into the stuff that you put on the page.
Right.
You know? And I did all of that. And then I sort of booked the demo. The game went away. Then it came back. It was a new team. They sent out the audition again. And apparently for the second round, they auditioned like well over 2,000 people. Jeez. I don't know, all over the world over there.
Everybody and their brother wants a shot at that role. Right.
So I sent in my original audition plus some new lines that they had attached.
Yeah.
And I booked it again. I booked that game twice, which is a very proud moment. But at that, and Al had final approval, but he did not know it was my voice. I found that out later, and I didn't tell them at the time that I had any relationship with Al either.
Yeah.
Because I really, it was a point of pride. Like I wanted to earn that on my chops.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be perceived. Well, of course, Pacino's driver got the gig.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Man, we all know how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
It's like, guess what? It doesn't.
Yeah.
So I just kept my mouth shut about that for a long time. And then that game took a while. It took like 3 years to make.
Wow.
And
did you do any performance capture work in that game?
No, that was all done in Canada. I did performance capture as Tony Montana for something else.
Did
later.
You really?
They did Tony Montana's Crib. Like Cribs, the TV
show
Cribs.
Yeah.
And so I did a whole performance capture, which was a thrill to do Tony in the office and all of that.
Oh,
you know?
Man, what a blast.
But that was sort of a promo for the game. But for the game itself, and the performance capture is great. The guy who was doing them up there, they had the right physical presence. It was wonderful.
That's awesome.
It's like the greatest PS2 game right before PS3 was coming out.
Yeah.
And so you look at it, it's like Godfather game was PS3.
Yes.
And so, but they released it in PS2 because they knew their buyer's market still only had PS2. So it was right on the cusp. But so it was like during one of the late sessions that it came up, and I just asked them straight out. I said, because he took about a year to finally sign off on the game because he did have final approval of the voice and the whole thing. And,
wow.
And I know Al's process. He takes a long time to deliberate and decide. And, And so once I heard he had final approval, I was like, oh, God, this is never going to happen. You know? And then it did. And then, but I said, by the way, when you gave Pacino the choices to choose the voice, did you attach a name to each audition or just the audition? He goes, oh, no, we just had guy number 1, 2, and 3, and we had yours up first. You were the guy that we wanted, and we had two other choices, but you were the one we wanted, and he, oh yeah, it's guy number 1, you know. And so
that's so great.
So I booked it, and then I sort of told them a little bit of my history, and they were like shocked that I knew him. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, because I've said this in other interviews about it, which you're not just doing you're doing Al's version of a Cuban accent. You're doing a guy from the Bronx doing a Cuban accent. So the fact that I understood Al's nuances so well.
And his process, and you're matching the kind of actor he is to the choices he made.
Right.
And,
but those all come off of who we are as people. That's the difference. Like we can all those of us who are mimics can mimic our favorite actor pretty well when we see them in a movie. But when you know someone,
yes,
you really absorb their tics and you can think of them. And so in that regard, I had a much more personal, fortunately, personal understanding of the way Al, he has just habits when he's finding a thought, you know, and that kind of thing. And so that you can just put into a line in the way that it just sounds natural.
So with matching that you don't have a personal relationship with guys that you don't know or guys that you you know, like, for example, what you've been doing, like on Puss in Boots, for example, or some, I mean, the, yes, the many
of
other course, things.
Of course, when I do Puss in Boots.
How do you go about the process
well, of course,
of breaking down
the
a role?
Process of Puss in Boots is you would first you listen to Antonio Banderas in other things that he does.
Assassins.
You know, assassins and all.
Zorro.
You know, and then you slide. As he gets older, he began to whisper even more, you know. And then you look at the Puss in Boots and you infuse it. It is an honor to put my life on the line for you.
You know, and so you just absorb all of those things. But yeah, I always want to hear, what do they sound like talking? What do they sound? Yeah, you try and absorb as much of the nuance of all of them again so that you can familiarize yourself with what do they naturally sound like before they are performing this character.
Yes.
Yeah, so especially for Puss, having a baseline of Antonio Banderas and then him doing a very regal character, you know. So that's where that comes from when you do those.
With creating original characters that aren't rooted in other guys. I mean,
right.
And you know, you can find yourself in a box. I mean, as a matcher, that's been my way into things, but there's been other characters that I've gotten to create from scratch. What's your process in that? If you get sides and it's like, you know.
You know, it's interesting. I've always sort of taught I've given lectures at different video game colleges.
Really?
As sort of like, here's the actor's perspective. What do we do every day when we audition?
Yeah.
So trying to teach these future game producers, writers, creatives, you need to know exactly what you want and be able to communicate that in your spec so that when you're going to receive 500 auditions for a character, you're not going to waste my time, but mostly yours. You got to listen to all these things. And if you're not really accurate about what you're asking for, you're going to be frustrated.
That's really
and
true.
So, you know, I would sort of sit with them and I was like, okay, you know, the same thing we deal with every day when we look down, we walk into our agent's office, they hand us a piece of copy. How old is he? How tall is he? Hopefully there's some art. Often there isn't.
Yeah.
You know, but if you have a drawing of the character, even better. Psychological profile. What movie star do you wish could play this part?
Yeah.
You know, and don't just say Anthony Hopkins or Gandalf. Because they're, they're
radically different.
We get that all the time.
All the time.
Like, they're nothing alike, and Gandalf is Gandalf.
Right.
You know?
And Ian McKellen is very different
from
Gandalf.
You know, but they always do that. And it's like, Anthony Hopkins doing Hannibal Lecter or what? You know? So it's funny. You get all, I would sort of like get them narrow it down. So I go through that same thing in the way that we've learned to spec. I sort of just imagine, and I've absorbed through life, through characters, through the weird voice bank. Sometimes, for example, one of the wonderful characters that I've gotten to do is King Bumi from the Avatar. You know, there's an airbender in our presence, and he has that old sort of New York. And he was actually based on a dear friend of mine who has passed away now, John Ryan, who was of another era. He was old New York money, and he had a very well-to-do family. And I'm exaggerating. John just had a great New York theater voice. He had one of those great sort of voices. And so I sort of gave it John with a little more elegance to it, you know, because they said he's this age and he's a little crazy, but he's sort of erudite. And, you know, that's all they had. There was no drawing of King Bumi or anything in the spec. And I auditioned it. And Andrea Romano was, I think, casting and directing at that time. And I guess she brought it in and I booked that. But then I saw the drawing of King Bumi. And he looks like my friend John Ryan. That's what blew my mind.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he looks like an exaggerated version of John Ryan, you know, which was always a one. But so he came off of a real person. Yeah. And the Khajiit, which is the cats in the, Elder Scroll. The Khajiit for Samskuma, I will leave him. So, yes, I based him on a Persian friend of my wife's who's a hairdresser. Who is always a little suspicious, you know, when she talks. She's, Ashraf is a little crazy and a little suspicious all the time, you know. So, like, I just sort of added Ashraf's voice to the Kashi, because initially they had sort of a scratch of what they wanted it to sound like.
Ah, interesting.
Match this, and then I just gave it my sort of Ashraf spin.
Yeah.
And I've done the Kashi many times in different versions of that game. The first one, I think, was Skyrim. The Liar was the first one, but I've done the Khajiit space. So sometimes it's based on a real person that you know, oh, perfect.
Yeah.
And, or it's a composite, you know, you and I were earlier talking about like Louis Anderson.
Yeah.
Understands He's playing that character right now on Baskets.
Yes, Baskets.
That's based on his mother, or he's playing his mother.
Right.
Yeah, and my grandmother was that generation of old Midwestern ladies, and Louis gets it. He grew up with those women, and cut that out, and just, my grandmother was in Detroit, and, she was of that, bless her heart, don't do that, that.
The worst thing you can do is disappoint those women.
Yeah.
They just give you a look of just disapproval, and,
don't. I'm so disappointed. Yeah. So that, you bring a character or you bring somebody you know to something if you can, or sometimes it's something you admire in a film, et cetera,
yeah.
And you sort of apply it, but,
yeah.
And you try not to repeat yourself, but
yeah.
Sometimes you do.
Sometimes you do. And there's no sin in that. If you like it and it works,
right now I've been watching Harlots on Hulu.
What's Harlots?
Harlots is all Cockney prostitutes in the 1780s in London. And so I've been watching that, like, addictively, two seasons of Harlots. And then sure enough, like, three different or four different Cockney auditions have come in the past.
my Jason Statham just got a lot better.
Oh, yeah. Jason Statham. That's actually the first voice match I booked. Jason Statham in the movie trailer.
But my Cockney, all the vowel sounds have gotten much better in the past couple of weeks because I'm hearing that every day watching that show.
Right.
So if you know you're going to have to do Northern Irish, just watch In the Name of the Father.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And you've got Pete Postlethwaite. You've got everybody.
Oh, boy.
That's the other thing. When you're doing an accent and you actors go to Samuel French, hopefully may
rest
it not
in
rest
peace.
In peace.
Yeah, right.
And they get these accent tapes on how to do an accent. It's very hard. I always organically did them. So to learn the paint-by-numbers
yes.
version is very confusing if you can organically do it. I always say, if you have any ability to mimic, go get a movie with those people.
Yeah.
And you will much quicker absorb that way than trying to learn the rules.
I totally agree. I think the one, and I went to Samuel French maybe 6 months ago and bought a French one because I cannot get French.
Yeah.
I got a great ear for others, but the French, and that was the one that really helped me because it was really mechanical.
It was very mechanical too. Yeah, no.
Yeah. It was, I'm turning into an Indian, a terrible Indian accent. It was very mechanical. This is the French. That's not it at all.
But the other thing I always say about the French people, I could always do French pretty well,
mm-hmm.
but until I went there to Paris and met them, because Paris is different than the rest of France, too. It's an attitude. Just like
yeah.
New York is not like America,
Yeah.
And so, the way the spiel I always have on doing the French accent or a Parisian accent is that Italians are inclusive people. Hello, Keith, come with me and my family, my mother, my father.
Ah.
He's very nice. Come, you see. We eat. I don't know you, but I love you, The Parisians or the French are an exclusive people.
Huh.
I like you, but this much, There is distance.
Yes.
I must approve of you. I will look you up and down. I will decide if you are to be allowed in, They don't have that. Now, someone from Brittany or Normandy has a much more, Marseille has that Southern European. They're much more. But the Parisians, there is always a bit of cool.
That's
you
so
know?
Interesting.
And so I didn't tell I went to Paris and experienced that. Then I could mimic it because it was it was the psychology.
Yes.
The emotional state of the culture through the voice.
That's
and
so
that's true of most accents.
Well,
if you know where you're from, I always say that to people. Well, what English accent are you doing? And where is that person in that social scale? Or what kind of Texan are you?
Huh.
You're not just doing, I'm going to do a Texas
this
accent.
This is my accent.
I'm doing it now for you.
Right.
It's like, no, where are you from? What is your status? All of that infuses how you speak. And also, as I say, the way you move affects the way you speak.
Yeah.
And the way you speak affects the way you move if you're lucky enough to do a motion capture of a performance, So all of that comes into it. But yeah, that was the French one was to, once you spend time, you start to learn, The other one was, I took French in high school and we would learn to say oui for yes, hello, oui. And then I went to Paris and they would answer the phone and they'd be on the phone and they'd, ouais, ouais.
Like, the mouth was never completely closed, you know. I'm so bored, I can barely articulate. So, you know, just the way we would say, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but someone in Europe learning English learns to say yes, you know, but right. You come to America and everyone's going, yeah. You know, it's the same thing. Every culture has its ticks. You know? So dude, learning where you're from helps the voice you're doing.
I could talk a whole nother hour with you.
Well,
about
my
all
pleasure,
this stuff,
my friend. This has
I wish I could. Our time is running quick. How can people find you on social media? Are you active on social media?
I am on everything. I am. I have a website. www.andresolyutso.com. Of course, you have to be able to spell my name.
That's all right. The spelling is in the description of this episode.
Wonderful. Then I'm on, I have a Facebook fan page. I'm also on Instagram at Andre Solyutso. So I'm sort of, you can look at me on Instagram, Facebook, and my website, and they're all sort of interconnected. Each one can lead you to the other.
And you've got
Twitter.
And Twitter as well.
And Twitter.
And you've got a really cool, project comes out
this
at the end
Friday,
of this
Friday, in 2 days, we have, Blood and Robots, right? Directed by Tim Miller. Love, Death and Robots.
Love, Death and Robots.
It's going to be on Netflix, and that's a wonderful project directed by Tim Miller and headed by David Fincher. And it's a bunch of different short animation, maybe some are live action, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And I worked in the one that Tim Miller directed, but they had directors from all over the world.
Wow.
Do all these different short scripts, so they will all be different kinds of animation, different styles, so it's just this wonderful international fusion of all of this stuff. And Fred Tatasciore, Nolan North, Scott White. There's a awesome. Bunch of us. So it's a really, really fun project.
Fantastic.
I've got that. I've got also coming out is a wonderful documentary that's about to is already out, but it's called Who Will Write Our History, which is one of the more meaningful projects I've gotten to do as a voice actor, because you're reenacting the voice. Very quickly, Who Will Write Our History, where this group of Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto called the Oneg Shabbes, they were rabbis and intellectuals and teachers, and they started journaling and keeping these heartbreaking diaries of what was happening to them as the ghetto was being exterminated.
Oh my God.
Most of them were exterminated. 3 of them survived after the war. All of these letters and journals were buried under a house that they came back to. So imagine you had, you know, 1,000 diaries of Anne Frank, not just one.
Oh my God.
And so this wonderful Roberta Grossman did a documentary, did reenactments, but a few of us voiced these actual letters.
Wow.
So you're not just doing a voice, you're reading someone's last testament on earth that they wanted people to know about. So
wow. It
was tremendously moving. So I got to do one of the characters and also some BBC newsreel guys, which are always fun to do. The Nazis coming in. It's a horrible, you know, doing the wonderful
news on the march.
They're on the march to Poland. Yeah, so yeah.
That's
so
great.
That Who Will Write Our History and Love, Death, and Robots. Yeah, so.
Oh, that's great. We'll be on the lookout for it. I always enjoy talking with you. You're
My
one
pleasure.
Of the most passionate, in particular, your recommendations on documentaries.
Always, thank you.
It's I don't know why that's one of the things that jumps out, but we always have very spirited conversations
yes.
about that. And your recommendations are never wrong.
Oh, well, thank
and,
you.
And your insights as an actor, as well as an impressionist and a friend. It's just awesome to be able to
My
spend
pleasure.
Some time with you.
Thank you, Kiff. It's been a long time coming, but I'm thrilled to be here, and I've always loved your show. I listen to it whenever I can.
Oh, thank you so much.
All
and
right.
And I also want to send a special thank you to Juice Studios here in
yes.
Santa Monica, marvelous studio where I had my first booking in L.A. at Juice Studios.
In fact, another shameless plug, Sekiro, the game which is coming out.
Sekiro.
That the beautiful, beautiful game I recorded here at Juice Studios.
Did you really?
Yeah, a few months ago, and that's
so
just
awesome.
About to come out too. So
fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait for that one. That's going to be a lot of
awesome.
Fun.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for
Thank
listening.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for being here. And we'll be doing more episodes coming very soon.
Wonderful.
Peace.
Keep listening.
This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at Kiff VH or on Instagram at Kiff VH or on Vero at Kiff VH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
There,